Coming up on Boston Public Radio, New Hampshire fails by one vote to eliminate the death penalty. 32 states and the federal government have it, but is it time to part company with China, Iraq, and Iran on the ultimate punishment? Then Kelly Crossley above and under the radar on a local pirate radio station being shuttered and a Boston Strong license plate being approved. Then Globe reporters Jenna Russell and Scott Hellman join us to talk about their new book, The Long Mile Home, which adds much to the history of the week last April, which none of us will ever forget.
Greater Boston's Emily Rooney details her interviews with marathon survivors and what you tune in for each week, her world-famous list of observations and complaints. Then our Friday news quiz with a father-daughter pair who are both marathon runners and physicians. They came to the aid of the injured after last year's bombing. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So, when North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, executed his own uncle, remember that? The brutality of North Korea's regime was once again put under the spotlight on the world stage. But in a broader context, this is amazing. When it comes to executions, the United States, between 2007 and 2012, listen to this, executed twice as many people as North Korea. And to add a little irony into the mix, President George W. Bush, once the governor of a state famous for sending people to the gallows, of course, and understandably, included North Korea in the axis of evil. Well, today, 32 states in the U.S. have the death penalty. You probably know that yesterday, the New Hampshire Senate failed to knock that down to 31 by one vote. Lawmakers in the Senate voted 12-12 to repeal the death penalty. Obviously, the tie means capital punishment will stay on the books. Here's a little bit of the debate before the final vote yesterday. In order, you'll hear Democrats, a senator, Donna Soucy, another Democrat, Senator Betty Lasky, and finally, Republican Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley.
I am struggling and have struggled with this decision like nothing else. And I know so many of you are struggling today.
State-sponsored execution is not justice. We stoop to the level of the killer, and it changes nothing.
Because I believe that there are some crimes that are that heinous, I support the death penalty.
And that's what we want to talk to you about today at 877-301-8970. We are going to try, and I assume we will fail, Marjorie, at avoiding the typical pro and con death penalty thing. What we prefer to focus on, but we're not going to be rigid, is why are we the one outlier amongst major Western nations in the world? We'd particularly like to hear from people in New Hampshire 24 hours after their Senate blocked the repeal. 877-301-8970. By the way, if you're wondering, Maggie Hassan, who's the relatively new governor, says she would have signed the repeal had it gotten to her desk. And interestingly, I've forgotten this until this morning.
I was stunned by this.
Jean Shaheen, now the United States Senator, who's being challenged by a bunch of Republicans, including most notably, obviously, Scott Brown. Jean Shaheen, when she was governor in 2000, vetoed a bill that had passed the Senate and the House, which would have repealed New Hampshire's death penalty. 877-301-8970. Why do you think? I mean, let me read this list of people. And of course, obviously, some populations are larger. Here's between 2007 and 2012, Marjorie, the top 10 executing nations, for lack of a better expression. China's number one. Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, the United States. United States between Iraq and Pakistan. After Pakistan is Yemen, North Korea, Vietnam, and Libya. That information is from Amnesty International. It's rather amazing,
I know.
Actually.
Well, I think there's something about our kind of cowboy, macho, frontier kind of thing that makes us feel that we need to do this. But, you know, as all these studies point out, there's absolutely no evidence that that death penalty is a deterrent. It costs taxpayers millions and millions of dollars. They're talking about this one case up in New Hampshire, which has already cost New Hampshire millions of dollars. There's obviously a race issue here. The guy in New Hampshire is a black guy that's on death row up there.
And which, by the way, this wouldn't have applied to. You know, this would have been the exception. They would have been allowed to proceed with his ex, is his name Addison, right? His execution,
yes.
Yeah.
Killed a police officer. Yeah. But the point is, race often plays a very big role in this. And as your buddy there, what do they call the Innocence Project?
Yeah, Barry Sheck, the Innocence Project.
Has pointed out that people are often, quite often actually, wrongly convicted of, you know, the judicial system in the United States is all about money. You know, you get a great lawyer, you do very well. You don't have a great lawyer, you don't do very well. And many people who wind up on death row are people with bad lawyers, lawyers who fell asleep during the proceedings, lawyers who didn't offer their client a good defense. So it's very unevenly and unfairly applied. It's just a bad situation. And we've read about the alleged bomber Tsarnaev. It is not as if you're having a day at the beach in these prison cells. You're in a cell all day long. You can't read. You can't watch television, listen to the radio. They clip apart the newspapers. You're limited to the numbers of letters you can write. I mean, it saves the taxpayer a lot of money. You wouldn't think so, but it does to just have people in jail.
Well, so Marjorie violated our rule in 10 seconds. So you may violate it. No, it's perfectly fine. You can violate it too. 877-301-8970. But in addition to making your case, as Marjorie made hers against it, why are we where we are?
Macho nation.
Well, I said, but there are no other macho nations in the Western world other than the United States of America. It's just a little hard to believe. By the way, if you're interested, I believe it's a Pew Center poll. Support for the death penalty is down to 55%. It was at 61 or 62, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. Huge, huge majorities of white Americans and religious Americans support the death penalty, and other subsets of the population don't. I mean, it clearly has changed. You remember 1992? Bill Clinton is running for the presidency. He's campaigning around the country. He rushes home to execute, to allow the execution to go forward,
right,
of a guy who had some mental impairment issues. This is in 1992 during the election. And and the guy ultimately was put to death. Well, I was going to say, I can't imagine a candidate doing that in 2016. But of course, I can imagine a candidate doing it in 2016. But even the Supreme Court of the United States, when they considered giving the death penalty to younger convicted murderers, has moved. This is one of these things. It's almost embarrassing to say, just like gay marriage, we're going to get to a point where it's going to be legal throughout the land. We're going to get to a point, I think it's safe to say, where the death penalty is outlawed throughout the land. I would guess, based on a Supreme Court decision sometime in the next 10 years or so, that it's cruel and unusual punishment. But we're not there yet, and we want to know why. 877-301-8970. And New Hampshire, by the way, is not some left-wing liberal state. It's a pretty moderate state.
Yeah,
and again,
is.
One vote had switched in the Senate, and the death penalty would have been abolished yesterday in New Hampshire.
And I think it was very interesting that the one man who's facing the death penalty up in New Hampshire, who said he's from Dorchester, he's a black guy.
Oh, he is from Dorchester?
Convicted of shooting a Manchester police officer. Mm-hmm. The police officer's own partner has made a 180-degree turn, as this Globe story points out. He originally wanted Addison's killer, that is a police officer who was killed, to be put to death. But he says, this is his quote, "What was I trying to accomplish? What is anybody trying to do? It's not going to bring anyone back. It was revenge on my part. That's all it was." And it's very interesting when you look at these cases of people that are initially after the crime, vehemently in favor of the death penalty, how often over time, and sometimes not that much time,
well, you broke the story on one of them. Why don't you tell that story?
Well, it was...
Wasn't that your story? Weren't
yes,
you the first?
It was. I think so. It was a terrible crime. You may remember in Cambridge, in your neighborhood, a little 10-year-old boy, Jeffrey Curley, was abducted by these pedophiles, and he was assaulted, and he was murdered. And his father, who works in the firehouse right near you...
Who
was,
since has become a very good friend of mine,
yes,
by the way,
was
Bob Curley.
At the time, totally in favor of killing both these men.
And was the poster boy for Paul Cellucci's campaign to bring to back the death penalty in Massachusetts.
And he did a 180-degree turn, and we always thought that part of it had to do with the fact that he rode in a car when we used to do a TV station, TV show together out at NECN. He rode in a car out to NECN with the father of a woman that was killed in Oklahoma City by Timothy McVeigh, who also started out being a let's fry this guy immediately, who also did a 180.
Bud Welch.
Bud Welch, his name was. That's absolutely right. And so I think that that the two fathers together bonded over this and came to the same conclusion that the police officer's partner did.
You know, I want to say one thing about this. There's a great book that was written. Is it called The Ride? I feel bad that I don't know about Bob Curley's move by a Globe reporter.
It's a
terrific...
Is it Brian McCrory, the same guy
who
wrote this
but
story?
But I'm not sure if it's called The Ride. In any case, very briefly on this, when Marjorie and I did do a television show together, which Alex Beam called Under the Radar, it was the best half hour I've ever seen on television. It had nothing to do with either of us. These two men who'd suffer the most grievous loss one can possibly, a child, as Marjorie said, one in Oklahoma City, one this gruesome, horrible murder of a Cambridge kid. there was a point at which, even though they had passionate disagreement, where their faces were within inches of each other on the television screen. Two men, again, lived an experience no one else would ever want to live, who had different worldviews. And as you say, at the end of the day, years later, I think it was a year or two later, Bob Curley became a passionate opponent of the death penalty.
And speaks out now.
Oh, he does, yes.
He does.
He's great.
He's a terrific speaker, and he's a terrific guy. 877-301-8970 is our number. Why are we the outlier among what we would call the more, civilized countries in the world? Reed and Franklin, what do you think?
First-time caller. I have to say, as far as personally, if somebody's committed such a heinous crime, I think that death penalty should be warranted. I think it obviously should apply to each case. But what you said earlier about the possibility of them saving money by keeping them in jail and, you know, clipping up the newspapers or whatever, I'm just not for that. I think somebody's ready to go to that step.
Hey, Reed, we're going to put you on hold for 1 second. We're not going to get rid of you. The connection is so bad, but we do want to hear your whole thoughts. So stay on hold. We'll take another call, and we'll get back to you. 877-301-8970. A couple of months ago, by the way, the Washington governor implemented a moratorium, at least until the next governor takes over. His name is Jay Inslee. And I'm looking for the numbers, but there's something like, I believe there were a dozen or maybe 19 prisoners who'd been on death row, and I'll confirm this number in a second, but there is a significant number, who ultimately were proven to be innocent. And if you recall, Mitt Romney attempted to do a narrower death penalty only for certain crimes and only where, as he would describe it, there was certainty. But let me just describe one quick. Remember my former boss, Iris Adler, who used to make documentaries?
Yes.
She made a documentary, not about a murder case, but about a rape case, about a rapist who spent decades in jail, never got to see the daughter who was just born afterwards. It was based on eyewitness testimony and of the rape victim. And he, in this documentary, they describe other rape cases. The scene that I'll never forget, and ultimately he got out because he hadn't done it, thanks to the Innocence Project and DNA evidence. There's a woman, I think from North Carolina, sitting on a bench with a convicted rapist who had also been in jail for a couple of decades. He had gone to jail based upon the eyewitness, good faith eyewitness description, identification of him as the rapist. And it turns out he was not. And there is this moment in this film where the two of them, the rape victim and the alleged rapist, who wasn't talking about the mistake in the most moving way ever. So for those who say, well, we'll only do it in certain cases, eyewitness testimony in the heat of chaos and emotion and violence and passion is often not reliable evidence.
Well, this New Hampshire death penalty law is not limited to, but it includes contract killings and murders connected with kidnappings, but it's mostly about law enforcement officials, policemen, judges, mm-hmm. corrections officers. And as one person says in this, well, what makes a law enforcement person's death more worthy of the death penalty than something else? I mean, children are not included in here.
But by the way, according to these articles, they're the primary advocates. The Police Chiefs Association and other mm-hmm. police groups are the primary advocates for retaining it.
Barbara in the car. What do you think, Barbara?
Okay, thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I will go to my grave not understanding how people can say they support the death penalty because it brings closure, because they've lost someone. To me, that's an insult. I would be insulted from my place in heaven, which, of course, is where I'd be.
Of course.
With Michael Bloomberg, actually. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's going there, too. He just informed us.
If I had been killed and my family were satisfied because they put some person to death who had killed me. Now, thank God we're in Massachusetts, but because there's no very often if a person is killed by someone they know, they're not the ones who are brought to it. Doesn't become a capital case. It's always a person who's unknown to them and typically a minority. All those things that you've been saying, I just don't understand. understand it.
Well, you know, Barbara, there's a great book, and it's an old book now, but I think it's still relevant. It's called Dead Man Walking by Helen Prejean.
Oh, yeah.
It became a movie with Susan Sarandon, I think, was the star playing the nun.
Oh, I know. I taught criminal justice, and I dealt with all these students who wanted the death. I always found it really difficult. I thought it should be an acid test. If you believe in the death penalty, then you shouldn't become a police officer. Now, I know that's not going to make me popular.
Barbara,
thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for the call. Well, Barbara knows the story, but I'll just finish it very quickly. Is that that's what she studied. She was criticized for not interviewing the victims, and she probably should have. But the point was that the families that thought the death penalty was going to bring them so-called closure would go to these executions and leave with a very, is that all there is? That's it? I feel just as bad now as I felt before. And she talked about its impact, too, on the people that work in the prisons, the people that the prison guards and so forth. The basic point of the book was that it doesn't bring that elusive closure at all.
Also, the implication one gets when you have these discussions is that all these other Western nations are soft on crime. They're far from it. You know, you who articulates at least my position on this better than anybody else, whom I rarely cite, Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly is against the death penalty, and his view is in part a function of mistakes being made that are irreversible. But if you want somebody to suffer, it would seem to me that if you had a choice between an injection where someone is gone, unless they screw it up, which they've done lately, in 30 seconds, wouldn't you like to see someone suffer for 60 years every minute thinking about what they did to another human being?
Well, also, you read about these supermax prisons, and Frontline is doing a big piece
next week about
people in solitary confinement. So we're going to be talking about
like
it
the younger
as well.
Tsarnaev.
Yes. So, you could say that really the easy way out is the old injection in the arm with the drugs put in there first, so you kind of are a little bit of a state of gaga-ness when you go.
So this is one of these. Remember, did you read the great story in the New York Times the other day that talked about the how Barack Obama ultimately ended up saying he was for gay marriage? And it was a long story, not just that Joe Biden spoke out of turn and then basically put him in a corner.
He was evolving for a long time.
But virtually
he?
All the people around him say, we never believed he was against gay marriage to begin with. Do you believe Barack Obama supports the death penalty?
No, I don't.
Nor do I. But it was politically necessary. And there is going to come a point, probably in our lifetimes, where the Supreme Court, I think even a conservative Supreme Court, is going to say that this is violative of the Eighth Amendment.
Wayne Daniel in the car. Thanks for calling, Wayne Daniel.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
I wanted to respond to Jim's question and to Marjorie's question about why we're such an exception in the world community on this point.
Yep.
And I think we might have here kind of the most perverse end of a really perverse doctrine, which is American exceptionalism. Like, we need to be different from everyone else. It happens with the death penalty. It happens with national health care. It happens with renewable resources. Like, there's an idea, I think, in our culture that somehow if everybody else does it, there's got to be something wrong with it. We have to be better, and better means different. I think if the rest of the world community, had the death penalty, we'd outlaw it. Because we have to be exceptional constantly. It's part of the ego of this nation.
Well, I don't know if you're right, but that is one incredibly great analysis. Wayne Daniel, thank
like
you
that.
Much for
that
the call.
That is an out-of-the-box analysis, too. Why didn't you think of that, Jim?
Well, but it's a good one. And by
it's
the way,
I
think there was a modest piece of tongue-in-cheek. It's not that preposterous, as we know better on all these things, but apparently we don't. If you just tuned in, again, we are ahead of North Korea on the list of top 10 executors of prisoners in the United States, and it's and it's so clear if you look at the Innocence Project work. And by the way, when she said my good buddy Barry Scheck, I went to law school with Barry Scheck.
He's done great work on this.
He has done great work.
He has
Peter
done
Neufeld,
great work.
Another kid I went to a law school with, part of the number two person there. They've done great. I tell you, if there was a vote, I've told you this repeatedly, in my law school class for least likely to succeed, it would have been Barry Scheck, by the way. But it's so obvious that people are put in prison or on death row wrongly. And the beauty of life in prison, other than the length of the punishment, is you can correct the mistake. You can't correct
a
mistake.
It's also so obvious, you know, in my younger days, I covered a lot of trials, that whether it's not whether you're guilty or innocent, it's how good your lawyer is. I mean, that seems to be.
Well, look at the Jared Remy thing, which
exactly.
We talked about ad nauseum.
Exactly. Claire from, New Hampshire. Hi, Claire from New Hampshire.
Hello,
what
Claire.
Do you think up there in New Hampshire?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hi.
I think that, actually, believe it or not, that this was progress to have a 12-12 vote. I think your point about political expediency is really accurate. I think here in New Hampshire, because I'm kind of new to this state, the attitude of live free or die is much bigger than people know. And I just wanted to throw out there, I wonder how many states have a correlation between gun advocacy and supporting the death penalty.
Can you get back to what you said about live free or die? Explain that a little bit. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know the license plates say live free
or
die.
Oh, sure. No, I understand. Yeah, but what?
Right?
Yeah.
So every discussion here that's set in a town meeting or a state discussion is all about the government not imposing their belief systems on the people. That goes to not wearing bicycle or motorcycle helmets.
Yep.
Seatbelt laws, the phone laws in driving are only just getting discussed now. And like I said, I love it here. I love it here. But I'm new to the area, and I was just surprised by that live free or die is a real thing here. It's not just a slogan.
Claire, is a great call. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
for
and
it.
a great point as well. I am looking at the states without the death penalty, and of course, New England states, except for New Hampshire, have gotten rid of the death penalty, and New York, which is another, I suppose you'd say, fairly liberal state, New Jersey, Minnesota, Hawaii. I mean, a lot of the states with the death penalties are the ones that have a pretty good, significant gun culture. I can't say all of them, but a lot of them.
But again, apart from the gun culture, you surely do not need to be a bleeding heart type on crime to believe the death penalty is not something that a society should associate itself with. I mean, we've talked about this before. In terms of consistency, who is perfectly consistent on the death penalty, which an organization that is occasionally criticized on this show.
You mean the Catholic Church?
Catholic Church,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they got the seamless thing.
Exactly, from conception to
natural death.
Exactly. And
yeah.
Again, they've lobbied pretty relentlessly against the death penalty whenever there's been an effort. Most recently and most notably against Paul Scalucci. For those who don't remember this, it passed. Tom Finneran was the Speaker of the House. He called in a particular state rep who had voted for it. I believe his name was John Slattery,
yes,
if I'm not wrong.
Yes, it was.
And lo and behold, Representative Slattery had an epiphany. And Representative Slattery changed his vote, and it failed by one vote.
Well, what was a kind of a sad situation was that this horrible death of this little boy became
Jeff Keller,
a political football. It became the, you know, if you don't support the death penalty, you don't care about Jeffrey Curley. It was a really ugly fight back then. Let's go to Cheryl from Cambridge. Hi, Cheryl.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you, first-time caller?
Oh,
well,
thank you for calling.
Yes. I thought that the two main factors that contribute to us being the biggest executors on the planet is race and money.
Yeah.
Both of those shape our policy on the death penalty. We haven't dealt with our problem on race, except in ways of criminal justice, and it shows that there is a significant amount of bias in sentencing that's proven, and they're trying to fix some of that today.
Let me just interrupt for 10 seconds. I mentioned the moratorium that was declared recently in Washington State by the governor. I think I have these numbers right. 50% of the people on death row are African Americans. 4% of Washington's population are African Americans. I mean, that it's right there, and that's not atypical. So you make a very fine point.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the call, Cheryl.
Thank you for the topic.
Oh,
thanks.
Sure. Let's go to Nora in Dedham. Hi, Nora.
Hi, Nora.
Hi. How are you?
We're good. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm totally in favor of the death penalty. Of course, I think there has to be a very thorough investigation of the crime and a very fair, of course, trial. But I'm in favor once it is decided, once it is without doubt clear that the person is responsible for a crime, I think yes, the death penalty should be put in place. Why? I don't believe that it will give the family closure. Maybe it will in time. I don't know. Maybe there is a sense of revenge, although that's not positive. But my main reason is for practical reasons. I think that all that money that is spent in maintaining this person throughout who knows how many years all the resources, the medical attention that, of course, he has or she has to receive once in the system. That money should be used to improve the jails for those who are not sentenced to.
Nora, if I may interrupt and respectfully correct one fact, and obviously your opinion is your opinion. Factually, it has been demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that it is more expensive to execute someone than it is to keep them in prison for life. And
because
part of the
legal reason
is the mandatory appeals that they're entitled to. The cost is, so if cost is, as you just said, a major determinant for you, then frankly, you should be for life in prison. One thing for you, though, Nora, you say you want there to be a degree of certainty, and I'm glad to hear those who are proponents of the death penalty, 55% of Americans, including you, I hope feel the exact same way. But in the vast majority of these cases where DNA evidence, for example, has demonstrated that someone on death row didn't belong there because they had nothing to do with the crime, the jury would have said there was total certainty. So how do you deal with the fact that the evidence since the Innocence Project and Barry Scheck started work suggests that there have been mountains of mistakes made?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. That it's a process. I don't think you can do it from one day to another, and that has to be cleaned up and checked out. And as to the appeals, I think that there should be a certain that would be one thing that has to be reviewed, and have a limitation of the number of appeals. Because if there is, I mean, you would think that there's an appeal because there's a doubt. Then, well, how many doubts are there going to be? If there's so many doubts, then that person cannot be on death row.
Yeah.
Nora, we appreciate your point of view, and thank you very much for the call.
In this one case in New Hampshire that we talked about, this killing of a police officer.
Addison guy.
Yes, apparently the appeals at this point have already totaled into several million. They don't say how many million, but several million dollars. And that's one of these families of the murdered victims. That's one of their big things, that they say they could use that kind of money to help with counseling services and maybe some restitution services and crime victim hotlines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, we are moving on from this because we have got Callie Crossley in the house. She joins us every Friday. She's going to talk about the touch and go of touch radio, Record Store Awareness Day, and other big stories, big and small, from this week. Callie Crossley up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
An extreme sports video, Living on the Streets.
Homeless individuals have, you know, their own lives, and we don't yet have a great snapshot of what their daily experiences and interactions are.
Using GoPro cameras to document homelessness, some tech entrepreneurs try to upload empathy to an uncaring world. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead, and proud to support TED Radio Hour in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 11 p.m. here on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us, as she does every Friday, as the host of Sunday Nights Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. That would be Callie Crossley. Hey, Callie.
Hey, how are you, Jim? Hi, Marjorie.
We are excellent.
Hello,
thank
Callie
you.
Crossley. So we want you to tell us about this radio station, community radio station in Dorchester Grove Hall, run by Charles Clemens, ran for mayor earlier. What happened there?
Well, apparently, for some time, he's been under surveillance, if you will, not on a day-by-day basis, but it is well known to everybody that this is a pirate station. By that, we mean unlicensed, as the FCC licenses stations. This is low-power station. It's 100 watts. And Charles Clemens, who's the head of the thing, has built up quite a following in particularly areas of Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan. It's very popular. Everybody appears on it. Name a politician, they've been on it.
Governor and the mayor have been on it.
This is what I'm saying. Yeah. Many, many, many times.
Yep.
It's easy. It's harder for us to get Governor Patrick here than it is on touch. This is not unknown to people. In fact, just a few minutes ago, by the way, Governor Patrick has come out and said that he tried to ask the feds not to raid the station.
Oh, wasn't aware of that.
Yes,
really?
And that he thought this was, overkill. So the bottom line is that it was an illegal station. Everybody knew it. It was sort of like the open secret. I'm saying to myself, as Charles Clemens is running for mayor, is nobody going to say anything about the fact that he runs an unlicensed station? And in fact, that is what prompted the complaint, this most recent complaint. But he was fined in 2008. He started the station in 2007, fined in 2008, $17,000. Apparently has not repaid that. Another complaint lodged again when he was out in front running for mayor and proudly saying, as you would if he had a big audience, as he does, that I run this station. And the Fed said, yeah, well, but it's unlicensed. So when they raided, they took everything. I'm talking antennas, computers. It was a total shutdown. There's no way that he could come on the air Monday unless he could replace all of that equipment and defy them.
For those who are asking, why didn't he just get an FCC license?
Yes.
One, it's expensive.
Yes.
Two, it is very difficult. And I have to say, and by the way, a line he used, which may be a bit much, but during the campaign when he was asked about this, he described Touch as the Rosa Parks of radio. I don't know if I would have gone that far.
I don't think so either.
And the issue, yes, it's illegal. But the question, don't the feds have better things to do than be shutting down something that has provided a vehicle for a significant part of the community?
Well, also, this quote from this guy that said the radio station helped him raise money for a funeral when his mother died, and that other people saying that the only way they know what's going on in the community is through this radio station because it is so hyper-local, as you always talk about.
Yes.
That's what makes you feel kind of bad about
this. Well, okay, so a couple of things. First of all, there are regulations to the people's airwaves, and that's the people's airwaves. And so that's why the FCC is set up, is to make certain that there are some rules that people are following. Otherwise, you possibly have anarchy. I mean, we all know how important it is to be able to have a vehicle by which you spread messages or able to connect with people. So, the feds are protecting our interests in a global way. So you get down here in a very small way, then you say, well, what's this guy doing, really? Remember, they shut down a Haitian station that was unlicensed. There are probably others that they have an eye on. This one, again, because of the complaint lodged, because he put himself out there running for mayor. On the other hand, I understand the connectedness. Now, here's something that's interesting. Reverend Bruce Wall, who has an internet radio station, is in line or hoping, or until recently maybe, I don't know if he still is hoping, to be able to get an FCC license for a local station. He's in competition with the city and LaSalle College. Those are two other competitors. But so there are efforts to have a quote, black-owned or a focus in those communities, a fully licensed FCC station. I don't know if in recent events will now make it more difficult for Reverend Wall or not, but he was certainly on that path.
You're referencing, we should say, the whole thing with the commuter rail and the $105,000 invoice with his name on it that Adrian Walker wrote about.
Okay, one more thing. Last year, President Obama recognizing that there is a need, for these low power stations who have made a connection to be there, signed an order to allow them to be there. But you got to apply to be approved again so that the FCC is running this thing, is paying attention to this. It doesn't appear that Charles Clemens applied. And our Adam Riley asked him specifically today, did you apply? And he said something about maybe they lost my application. I don't know.
Wait a minute. So it seems to be you're implying here that had he owned up on the $17,000 fine and not made such a ruckus about the station when he was running for mayor, he might have
Well, he probably could have flown under the radar, a phrase I'm fond of, for a little while longer, even though he's really out there because of the popularity of the station.
Yeah, because New York City, as one of these stories pointed out, has pirate radio stations all over the place.
Right, exactly.
For people that are recent immigrants, so they can, if they come here from wherever they come from, they can have their own little place to get community information.
And he's a 100-watt station, So there's some discussion about whether or not if you're 99 watts or 89 watts, maybe you're a little less, you're even more under the radar, and so they don't have as much interest in you. But I suppose if you get to a point where you are drawing the kind of crowd that he was drawing, and you put yourself out there, and you owe them $17,000, well, you know. Yeah. So, but again, Governor Patrick has asked the feds not to intervene, apparently is in conversation to see if there can be some resolution. So maybe what he can do is try to foster Clemens is getting one of these low-power licenses.
Speaking of Governor Patrick, mm-hmm. he has either signed or is about to sign. I think he may have already signed yet another, I don't know what they're called, specialty license plates in this state. If you collect enough signatures and you make an application, you can have a specialty license plate. There are things for breast cancer now. There are things for the Red Sox, that sort of thing. This would be a Boston Strong license plate. All the proceeds, not surprisingly, would go to One Fund Boston. What do you think about this, Kelly Crossley?
You know, I think it's another, because it's going straight to One Fund. This is not some one-off person deciding to make a license plate and then the money never gets to the One Fund. Why not? You know, it's a way for people who feel like they want to continue to support to do that. And it's a visible way for them to do it. What I was surprised about, I just sort of went online. There are already like five or six designs. You can get the Boston Strong with the city background, with the Celtics, with this, with that. I don't know how people have come up with the design so quickly, but... but there you have it. So as far as I'm concerned, no problem. I hope that it, you know, in coming years, it might, you know, be forgotten about or whatever or not draw as much money. But look, if you get a couple $1,000s a year for the One Fund for people we know who are going to have ongoing expenses, well, who's it hurting?
Well, it's not hurting. It's not hurting anybody. Yeah. And I think I don't know anybody who's against raising as much money, particularly when you read about the actual costs of some of these families are going to incur where someone lost a limb or that sort of thing. But I guess my position is the same broken record position I've had for a year is when's the license plate going to happen for the mothers who lost their kids
absolutely.
In the same community that Touch is trying to communicate with. And by the way, these are not mutually exclusive.
No.
It is fine and necessary to continue to raise funds for these survivors of what happened on Boylston Street and obviously Sean Collier. And obviously this morning there was a ceremony. But, it's time maybe for us, for somebody, to put up or shut up, collect signatures, get a license plate to show that it is one Boston, as we have discussed since April 15th of last year.
I think that could get a lot of support as well and should be something that's happening.
Well, on a more upbeat note, I'm embarrassed to say I'd never heard about
make
this
that two of
today.
Us.
Wow, you can.
I love this.
I never knew this even was going on or existed. Tell us, please, about Record Store Day this Saturday.
Well, it's Independent Record Store Day. That's what's important about it.
So Independent Record Store
Day. So you want to be, paying attention and supporting those independent record stores because, you know, it's a hard thing to do, particularly these days and times when people do a lot of downloading and, you know, digitizing. I live in Cambridge, so there's lots of them. I love In Your Ear. And then a long time ago, I had John Danroth from Planet Records on a show of mine, and he was great. Just talking about the excitement of having these records on vinyl particularly. So this year, I think it's great for Independent Record Store Day because vinyl sales are up. They are now 2% of all sales. Sounds like a small number, but people had, you know, said vinyl's dead, gone.
Why is it up? Because, like, traditionalists and because of the fun of
young
having
people.
Your turntable back
yes,
again?
Yes, young people, they like the sound.
But
they
is
like
there, the, that's yeah. what I was going to say, yeah. theoretically, yeah. could it be better? How can it be better sound?
Well, because it's a different kind of sound.
I see.
Sometimes,
okay,
you know,
they
sometimes,
last a long time.
Right.
Records last a long time.
So the record players are back. Vinyl sales are up. In fact, they are up 32% in 2012.
Okay,
that's amazing.
You always see not the records themselves, but the record covers at Urban
yes.
Outfitters and record players at Urban Outfitters. And I always think that they're just sort of a fun thing to have on your portable bar or something if you're 25 and whatever. But this is where do you buy the actual records? That's what I've noticed.
In Your Ear Records, Planet Records,
okay.
Cambridge. There you go.
Okay,
there's
so
the selling vinyl.
Anyway, two we know about in
yeah,
Boston.
Right. Well, and I know Cambridge. I know there are others, but this is Cambridge.
And while
yeah.
I am totally yeah. with Kelly, as you know, on the independents versus the chains,
yeah.
a chain that is local that actually has its headquarters about 100 feet from here, Newbury Comics.
They
Newbury
sell records?
Comics sells records too. It's not their largest
how much
section.
Are they?
I don't know. But you also, if you showed, you know, you were mentioning these 25-year-olds and their portable. I don't know what a portable bar is, but assuming I knew what it was for a moment.
I don't know, you roll it around.
Okay,
the apartment
fine. Yeah,
or
a lot of them have
I don't know
that.
What it is either,
okay.
actually.
Putting that aside for a second, if I took a turntable Denny High School in Boston and said to pick 20 kids out of the room and said, tell me what this thing is. How many of the 20 kids would know what it was?
Jim, they're all over the place at Urban Outfitters, so they would know.
Yeah. That people
really?
Are, yeah. And lots of people are now there are record players where you can, you know, stick the
cassette,
the plug in, and then put it on here to the DVD. Oh. You know, so people are transferring and doing all of that. I keep thinking I gotta sell some of mine. You know, I need to.
Do you have them? Do you still have records?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I saved my favorites too in the basement.
Yeah, I got tons.
Yeah, well, I put them in the basement. That was a big mistake. As it turned out, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
They're curved. I mean, they get a little warped.
Exactly.
And they get,
but I keep thinking I was going to put them on the wall in those, you know, those special frames that look so beautiful.
Oh, they're
in
great.
The homes of those people that have Grammys and whatnot.
They're great. No, they're that is what they sell those frames. They're a great Christmas present.
Yeah. Remember getting the dust off the needles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that.
Wait a second. So is today internet?
It's Saturday. It's Saturday.
Oh, it's Saturday.
And it's the
okay.
7th annual, I believe. So this is really interesting and exciting. And I love talking about it because I think it's so fun. And it probably will encourage people. And we got a lot of folks in town for the Boston Marathon. So it's a great activity for them on Saturday.
As it
they're,
is.
You know, relaxing to get ready for the run.
Yeah, you know, by the way, I happened to be down in Copley Square last night. It is jammed
yes.
with all the, already
that's
on
36,000 runners.
With all these people running around in sneakers. It's very festive and they have everything already set up. The finish line. So you could, if you drive down Boston Street, at least today, I don't know if it was true. It was true last night, maybe true today, but you can go right through the finish.
I couldn't get there, but in the spirit, I had 2 pounds of pasta last night for dinner. to get into the carbo loading part of it. Kelly, what's happening this Sunday night on Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley?
Yes, well, we're talking about a number of things. You know, some other stuff like, you know, the Elderly Commission report and this new proposal by Ayanna Pressley and Michelle Wu to have city workers who are transgender get their gender reassignment surgery paid for. That's kind of stuff. But, of course, we're leading this, you know, we're in between the anniversary of the marathon and also the upcoming marathon. So we're talking about a special tribute to Martin Richard in his own community while everybody else was doing that, a beautiful musical tribute that was done to him and to everyone who was injured and killed in that, at that time. And also I had a really interesting long conversation with Rainey Tisdale, whom you may know is the curator of the Dear Boston Messages from the Boston Memorial.
Oh, yes.
Marathon Memorial exhibit at the Boston Public Library, about her process and trying to select, about the importance of doing this, about, you know, why Boston needs a city museum to be able to capture these moments in the moment. And why these artifacts are so important, and the difference between the messages that people left then that are part of the exhibit, and they have a part at the end of the exhibit if you've not been, where people can now leave messages. The difference between the two in the year.
Well, that's great.
So it's a wonderful, yeah. By the way, I encourage everybody to go see that exhibit at the Boston Public Library.
Yeah, I've only seen it online. Yes. I got to get there because it looks spectacular.
Yeah. Thanks, Kelly.
Kelly Crossley is the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. You can catch her Sunday night. You heard what she's going to be talking about this Sunday night from 6 to 7 right here on 89.7. Up next, we talked to Boston Globe reporters Scott Hellman and Jenna Russell about their new book, which tells the story of the Boston Marathon bombings through 5 central characters. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Last year on Marathon Day, Boston Globe reporter Jenna Russell was at a coffee shop working on a story. Her colleague, Globe reporter Scott Hellman, was at a Home Depot. No, they weren't there when the bombs went off at the finish line, the marathon bombings, and the events which followed after the blast. From the people who were injured to the search for the Tsarnaev brothers became the focus of their reporting. They've woven together a handful of these stories into their terrific new book, The Long Mile, Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery, and The Epic Hunt for Justice. Jenna, Scott, good to see you both.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you both for coming in, and congratulations on doing a phenomenal reporting job. But I did want to ask you guys that before we get into the details of this. I mean, everybody was writing about this. Television was covering it. There's not that much left unsaid, although you did manage to find lots of things. Why this book? Why did you decide to do it?
So the value to us, of course, was to be able to step back and take this massive story and try to put it in some perspective and some context. And that's why we really wanted to settle on this idea of rooting the narrative in the experience of five principal characters. Because we thought, just as you say, everyone kind of followed this very closely around the world. We all know the basic details. We felt like it wasn't enough to just bring all that stuff together, right? We wanted to give you somebody to root for and follow and get to know a little bit. And so that was really why we started talking about doing it in this way and focusing on people, making it a human story.
Who were the five, Jenna Russell?
Well, we knew that we wanted to find somebody who was most affected by this. So we have Heather Abbott, who lost her leg after the second explosion. And then we knew we wanted to have a police officer who was there. So we found a young woman, Shayna Catone, who was at the finish line that day. And a doctor. So we were very lucky to find a doctor who actually ran the marathon and then rushed to the hospital and started operating on patients there, David King. And Crystal Campbell is one of the three people who was killed at the marathon. And so we wanted to connect with her family and go deep into that experience. And then finally, the director of the marathon, Dave McGillivray, provides a really good opportunity to look closely at this event, which is an incredible event with great history and is right at the heart of the story that we're telling.
Heather Abbott is the woman who had to make a decision about an amputation. Tell us about that, Jenna, a little bit, if you can.
It was very eye-opening for us to get to know her and to really understand what happened to her, because she got to the hospital Monday night and the surgeons were actually able to save her leg. And so she woke up Tuesday and she's thinking, I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm spared. And what happens over the course of that week is deterioration in her condition and ultimately an unimaginable decision that she has to make, whether to keep her leg and live a compromised life in that way or to let it go and to kind of forge a new path, which is ultimately what she chooses to do.
And tell us how she even was there in the first place.
So Heather, every year, she's from Newport, Rhode Island, part of a very close-knit circle of friends there. And every marathon day, they come up to the city, go to the Red Sox game, walk over to the finish line, hang out at this bar and restaurant called Forum. Great day, day they look forward to, kind of the kickoff of the spring season.
Yeah.
You know, were any of those five people reluctant, Scott Hellman, to talk to you? I mean, obviously, since this came out, it's right around the time of the anniversary, you started work. When did you start working on this thing? I mean, almost immediately after?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, May, June, we started to really put it together.
And were people, particularly the Heather Abbotts of the world, I mean, how anxious were they to tell any kind of a story?
That was the hardest part of this whole thing, as you can imagine. I mean, we tell difficult stories for a living. And what we have to do is build people's trust to say, you know, we're going to handle this responsibly and with depth. And
you had no time to build their
trust.
Yet
we had no time to do it. So in some ways we say, you know, look, take all the time you need. We know this is a complicated decision, but it was
but
like,
hurry
can
up.
You tell us tomorrow?
Yeah.
And indeed, I mean, we were so lucky to earn the trust of Heather and in the case of Crystal Campbell's family, her family, who were, you know, devastated, of course, by what had happened. And here we are a few months after coming in to say, we know you're trying to move on, but take us back to this really dark place.
But before we move on to some of these other people, and I'm particularly interested in the police officer, you had some great anecdotes, which was terrific about this book, about the little things you don't think about. Like when Heather Abbott comes back to Newt from the hospital, she goes into her bedroom and sees all the spring clothes she'd ordered, like lined up on the bed. You know, and then she goes like, what do you call it? Paddleboard? What was the thing she did?
Paddleboarding.
Yeah,
yes.
Paddleboarding. Tell us about her going paddleboarding.
Oh, so this was a great day that happened over the summer. Heather was a great connection for us, in part because her progress forward was really rapid, in a sense, compared to some of the other people who were badly hurt. So she was one of the first to leave the hospital, one of the first to go home, one of the first to go back to work and to resume an active life. And so she...
But that was even August, right? Did I read it, or am I wrong about that?
That she was paddleboarding?
No, that she went back to work. Is it before
that's
that?
That's right, in August.
So
yeah.
So really, that's significant. So that's April, May, June, July, August. That's like 4 months, and she was one of the first.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a pretty long time.
It is. And she really wanted to get back to these things she had always done. That was one of her early commitments that she made. I'm not going to give anything up. So she makes this date to go back to the beach and get up onto the paddleboard using a special prosthetic that she had. She has a whole collection of them now for different purposes. And she's in the water. I think this is what you're getting at here. And she's with her friend, and she's very nervous, and she's afraid people are looking at her and that they're, you know, watching her. And And this guy says, the stranger says, wow, you're really reckless or something like that. And she thinks he's talking about her getting up on the board with her, you know, prosthetic leg. And he's actually, but it turns out he's talking to her friend who has this incredibly expensive camera and she's in the water with it. And it's an important moment for Heather because she realizes, you know, people aren't looking at me as closely as sometimes I think that they are, and I can relax a little bit.
We're talking with Scott Hellman and Jenna Russell, who have written this terrific book about the marathon, The Long Mile Home, through the eyes of five different people that they've focused in on. One of them, and maybe I missed the story, is about this police officer, but I didn't see much, or if I did, I've forgotten. Tell us about this police officer who just quit drinking, you know, before the race and was debating whether or not to wear her bulletproof vest on the day of the race.
So Shayna is fantastic. She's very young, as you say. She grew up in New York. She was a teenager during 9/11, and it affected her very deeply. And when she gets to Boston to go to Northeastern, she falls in love with the city in part because she feels really safe here. And and partly because of that 9/11 legacy that she carries with her, she's a very cautious person. She doesn't mess around. She wears her vest, she says, almost all the time, even though a lot of officers don't. They're not required to after their initial training. But that day, and this is one example of all the little things that happen along the way that make this story remarkable. She, you know, it's marathon day. It's like a party in the city. It's people with their kids at the finish line. And she thinks, it's going to be a great day. You know, I don't really need to wear the vest today. So it's like the rare day that she doesn't wear it. And then the moment everything goes down, she thinks, I can't believe it. I can't believe today of all days. I don't have it.
And she was obviously responding right there at the scene to people with their grievous injuries.
Yeah, she was right there. She, like everybody, she hears the first blast and she thinks it's, you know, something else, hopefully. And then she hears the second and she knows in her gut what it is. And she was incredibly honest with us and she admitted, you know, her first impulse was to run away like so many other people, but that's not her job. And so she instead runs toward the second blast. And she's right there in the street, and she's holding the hand of one of the people who's bleeding and probably near death, and she ends up being instrumental in saving some lives. So she's struggled. I think she would tell you it's not easy still.
I want to talk about somebody else who didn't run away. This Henenberry guy whose house had the boat in the backyard. Before we do, Jenna just mentioned 9/11. You both did covered post 9/11 stuff for the Globe, did you not, Scott? How does covering something like that, which is obviously much more on a much more massive scale, but obviously this one is in our own backyard, how did they compare for you guys?
Yeah, that's the distinction I would make. I mean, as awful as 9/11 was, of course, and it was a much bigger tragedy, you know, it did feel a little distant, even though we knew the planes took off from here. It was kind of a Boston story, but it wasn't really a Boston story. There's no bigger Boston story than the Boston Marathon. And I think that's what makes this whole thing so awful is we've said a lot that, you know, any terrorist attack on any big event, a baseball game, would be, you know, terrible and heinous and so forth. But there's something particularly egregious about attacking the marathon. And so it did feel personal in a way. I mean, we all have experiences of going. We know friends who run. A lot of people at the Globe have run it themselves and are running it this year. So it felt much closer to home and therefore a very different reporting experience.
You live in Watertown, right?
I live nearby. I live over the river.
You do. This whole Henenberry thing, I mean, one of the great controversies was Governor Patrick, who we all just saw a couple of seconds ago, Governor Patrick declaring a shelter in place, pretty controversial. Even he had a conversation apparently with his friend, the President of the United States, about the controversy and having to lift it at some point. It's only when he lifts it that this guy who is meticulously concerned about his boat that he's been fixing in his backyard goes out not once, but twice to check this thing. And what hits me, everybody has praised the courage of the cops, as well they should. And there's nobody can dispute that. But the reality is they blew it. I mean, they did. The shelter in place didn't grab it. I think you guys wrote that it was less than a third of a mile away, a fifth of a mile away outside the perimeter that this thing was. What's Henenberry's story that he would not only go out once, but then saw blood and continued to look in the boat? What's up with this guy? Jenna, go ahead.
He is a unique individual. And yeah, that isn't one of those little fragments that we recovered in going back to people and spending time with them, is that he has this incredible moment at the boat where he sees the figure on the floor and he runs inside and calls 911. And he's kind of in shock, like he's saying to himself, did I really see that? Is it possible? And he's on the phone and the 911 operator says, is he still in the boat?
This is unbelievable.
It is. And Henneberry takes his portable phone and he walks right back out the back door.
Doesn't he go on a ladder to look in?
He didn't go on a ladder. I'm sorry, okay. But he went up behind the boat to see down the side up against the fence to see if the wrap was disturbed or if it was opened up. And he says, I'm pretty sure he's still in the boat. And the guy says, well, how do you know that? Well, I came back out here to check. Well, get in the house. He's about to go in the house when the SWAT teams come down his driveway.
Speaking of SWAT teams, one of my favorite little anecdotes. Marjorie said one of the great parts about this book is there are lots of little factoids or anecdotes that are just, they're fabulous. I hope I get this guy's name right. Rich Coriale, yep. Is that his name? He's one of the Mauldin SWAT team guys who ultimately goes down and gets the younger Tsarnaev. Can one of you tell the story about the phone call he gets from his wife, Scott? I love this story.
Sure. So, you know, the way that this unfolded, right, as you say, you've got SWAT teams all over Watertown. They're from all over New England, right? Everyone's got different streets and so forth. They get the call, I think at about 6:30 or so, 6:45, that 911 call that Henneberry makes, right? It filters out to the police. They've got him in a boat. This SWAT team from Mauldin is working some street. They're thinking, yeah, right, you know, we've been chasing false alarms all day. Sure, he's in a boat, you know. But then very quickly they realize it's serious. They rush to the scene. And it's this very tense thing, as you guys well know, where they come and Jahar is in the boat and the cops are, you know, descending on him. They start firing at the boat because they think he's trying to poke a gun through. Billy Evans, the commissioner now of Boston Police, tells everyone to stop firing, sort of this heroic moment for him. But then you've got the standoff and it falls to these Mauldin guys along with the transit police cops to get up there and get him off the boat. And so at one point, Rich Coriale, who's the commander of the Mauldin SWAT team, who spent some time with us, is basically getting ready to advance on the boat, right? The most tense moment in some ways for law enforcement of the whole week. And his cell phone rings and it's his wife. And she's evidently watching TV coverage of this, right? Because now everyone's descended, media's descended on this as well. And she says, hey, do you know that they've got this guy in a boat? And he's like, yeah, I'm standing on the driveway. And I'm not going to repeat what she says afterward because it's not family-friendly radio language. But it is this great sort of moment. And you know, really, what we try to do with the book is put some of those things in there because there's so few opportunities for levity and lightness in this subject.
Yeah.
But we didn't want to make it all sort of doom and gloom. And some of those sort of human moments, I think, really helped to make it a little easier read than it otherwise might be.
Well, this is not a moment of levity and lightness, but a moment of kind of very bad taste. Talk about the kids, some of the stories you heard from the guy at Marathon Sports of the poor taste remarks made when people would come into the store after it was reopened for business. If these were my kids, I would send a SWAT team after them. What the kind of stuff they say?
Yeah, so Marathon Sports, of course, is where the first bomb exploded right outside. And there's a wonderful guy there who's the manager of the store named Shane O'Hara, who's a well-known in the running community. You know, Marathon Sports is sort of a headquarters for runners in a way. In Marathon Day, there's no more special day for them. And he was really, he had a very difficult day. You know, the bomb goes off, he rushes outside, he's pulling down the barricades, he's helping treat the wounded. I mean, he was right there in the thick of it and really wrestled with it. So when they finally opened back up the store, you know, most people in the world, I think, respond to these things with tact and care and sensitivity, but few people don't. And there were people coming in, and they would just ask unprompted, you know, so where were the limbs in here? Were they over there, or, you know, did the bomb blow people into the store? Just not having any consideration for what the employees of the store went through. I mean, they were among the first responders, and that was really hard for him to deal with. And I think, again, not uncommon. And you don't want to ascribe further meaning to it because they're probably just dumb high school kids. But yeah, it was really damaging to him in those weeks.
That's the voice of Scott Hellman. Scott and his colleague at the Boston Globe, Jenna Russell, have written a terrific new book about the marathon and the aftermath called Long Mile Home. You know, Jenna, Marjorie and I, as this has gone along, every public official who has walked into this studio, we have relayed the most recent news about congressional hearings, law enforcement announcements, and whether it's about the Waltham triple murder and obviously the FBI now saying, and you cover the Waltham triple murder and obviously the whole thing with the Russians and the older Tsarnaev. And we say, if the FBI is telling the truth and Ibrahim Todashev was about to sign a confession saying that he and the older Tsarnaev were responsible for the triple murder in Waltham a year and a half before the murder, And they didn't even interview Tamerlan Tsarnaev, a very good friend of Brendan Mess. Do you at least entertain the possibility that if everybody at every level, federal intelligence people, local law enforcement, had done their job, that this thing could have been preventable? And I, my sense is, Marjorie and I have talked about this a lot, one of the reasons almost everyone says no is because they feel it'll be an anti-cop kind of statement. Actually, Commissioner Evans is one of the first people the other day who said to us maybe it was. How do you, what's your take out of this, having written that, seen what was gotten, what was missed about missed opportunities leading up to last April 15th?
I mean, it's an excellent question. It's one of the most important questions we can ask. And I don't know the answer, but I would certainly entertain the possibility that there were things that could have been done that would it have prevented it? I don't know, but it would have given us a better shot at it, I would say. In particular, that those murders in out there in Waltham, because you have, there's a gym owner who certainly was aware of the connection between Tamerlan Tsarnaev and one of these three people who ends up dead. And so you have to ask, you know, is that an interview that should have happened? It seems...
Well, beyond that, there were at least a few of Mess's friends who apparently said to law enforcement, his closest friend is Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and the older Tsarnaev was never interviewed.
That's what I wondered. Yeah. I wondered if it was because it was drugs, that you know, if it had been three, mom, dad, and kid blown up like that, throat slit, etc., there would have been more attention, but that because they said, well, it's a drug thing, and that's why they didn't look into it as hard as they might have.
I think that's a reasonable guess. I mean, we all do it when we read the news and we think, you know, you sort of think differently, right, when you hear details like that. And so I'm sure even among investigators, I mean, no doubt that they pursue every case, but I'm sure in the back of their mind sometimes they think, okay, we know what went on here, you know, paint by number kind of crime.
Yes.
And I mean, look, it's easy after these things to always say, well, we could have stopped him. But, you know, the fact is you have both on the local level with the homicide investigation and then the federal level with all the intelligence warnings. There were certainly, you know, multiple occasions where Tamerlan should have been known better. Now, would it have prevented it? Even Davis has said, you know, look, I would have liked to know that you were looking at him. Would I have done anything differently? I don't know. You know,
yeah, what Davis said in the hearing room right after the marathon, what he said when he walked out of the hearing room were just totally different things. He mentions in the hearing room the Joint Terrorism Task Force, had it been shared, the information, yes, he would have gone over to Norfolk Street and questioned the Tsarnaev brothers. And then when he comes out in the hall, it's sort of like, we can't be, and I'm reading into this, we really can't say that because we can't say that maybe this abomination might have been avoided. We're talking to Jenna Russell and Scott Hellman. You know, since Marjorie mentioned a gruesome anecdote, can I mention a lighter anecdote? We had the governor in here the other day, and thanks to your fine work, we learned what he was doing, at least on part, on Friday, right before the call came. Here's the governor describing how shelter in place affected him and his family. Listen up.
My daughter, Catherine, had sheltered in place at our home in Milton with my wife, Diane, and we checked in the course of the day, and I called. I said, I'm on my way home. What do you need? And they said, well, we're hungry. I said, okay, is there any food? And Diane said, no, why don't you pick up something? And I said, well, call this Thai place we like in Quincy. Call in the order, I'll pick it up. And I went on to Quincy, and I was waiting to pick up the food when the phone rang to say that they had identified the person who turned out to be the second assailant, the second Tsarnaev, in a boat in Watertown, get back down here. So I grabbed the food, I called Diane, I said, meet me at exit 10 on the expressway. I'll give you the food, keep going. And she came down, I gave her the food, and we came back and into Watertown.
So did you guys eat at Pad Thai after that, I hope? I mean, as good reporters would.
It's funny you say that. I passed it recently. I'm going to an event down in Hingham, and I had never been there. And I thought, oh, that's where it is. It's right there. Now, my question, which I don't know, I mean, knowing Diane, she probably saved his food for him, but I wonder, did they just dive in, you know, thinking he'd be gone? Or
we're not that good on the follow-up questions.
One last question for me, and we're talking with Scott Hellman and Jenna Russell. The book is A Long Mile Home. You talked about one of the people that you focused in on was Heather Abbott, who lost her leg and lived in Newport. Do you know what she's doing this year?
Yes, actually. I've talked to her recently, and she resolved very early on, last spring even, that she would be back at the marathon this year. So she and all her friends who were with her last year will be back actually at Forum, the same place where she has been there since. But yeah, it is sort of awe-inspiring in a way that that's where she's going to be and that's what she's going to do.
What are you two going to do on Marathon Day, Scott?
I think we'll be down there somewhere. I mean, I think we both want to be in the finish line area, certainly. It's hard to know exactly what our work responsibilities will be. But I think just as people, we both want to be there and feel it, like so many people here. I mean, it's going to be amazing if you can get anywhere near it, I'm guessing. But
yeah. Yeah, well, I think this year you're going to have to get there really early in the morning because I suspect that, I mean, it's crowded enough as it is already. That's one of the things I think is so... If there's any good thing that came out of this, it's the timing that it was when the finish line was not so totally packed with people a little later in the day that it's thinned out a little bit.
In any case, Jenna and Scott, great book. Thanks so much for sharing some time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jenna Russell and Scott Hellman are reporters for the Boston Globe. Their new book is The Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery and the Epic Hunt for Justice. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you much.
Great to be here.
Up next, it's time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney and her famous list of observations and obsessions. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org. Crash a tailgating party where stargazers spy on celestial bodies 500 million miles away. And it's legal at WGBHnews.org right now.
From hurricanes to healthcare to the Boston Marathon bombing, why all the events of the past year have made us stronger. I'm Kara Miller, this week on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Brigham and Women's Hospital, home to research on how aspirin can prevent heart attacks and other diseases. More available in a video at brighamandwomens.org/aspirin. Brigham and Women's, life, giving, breakthroughs. And the 2014 Lincoln MKX with 305 horsepower and an EPA estimated rating of 26 mpg highway. Actual mileage will vary. More details about Lincoln MKX are available at lincoln.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us in Studio 3 for Open Mic, and her famous list would be Emily Rooney. Hello there, Emily.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marge. How
are you? Hello, Emily. Thank you very much for coming in.
You got it.
So you had a bit on your show last night, which was terrific, about the story about a independent but unlicensed radio station in Boston's Grove Hall, that's in Dorchester, by the way, being shut down by U.S. Marshals. It was run by Charles Clemens, who ran for mayor and made no secret of it. Let's play a little of the sound from Greater Boston last night. It was a great piece by Adam Riley, I believe, correct?
Yep.
Yep. Okay, here it is.
It's about doing the right thing. This radio station, Touch 106.1 FM, has found lost children, has helped people that was committing suicides, has found lost grandparents, has provided food for the homeless, provided resources for people. How can you, with a conscious mind, shut down a positive entity, a positive radio station like this? There's no other radio station like this.
Okay, that was obviously a very emotional Charles Clemens. Again, he ran for mayor and he ran this radio station as well, which is no more.
And
as a
Touch 106.1.
Touch 106.1.
I mean, there is some backstory to this. There have been a number of complaints, including from your old employer at
WTK?
Greater Media?
Yeah.
Greater Media.
Because of the bleed over, you know. Magic is 106.7, so you don't want anything that's too close to another frequency. And that's why the FCC...
Because the interference.
Yeah. They parcel these things out based on, you know, the market and what the strength of the radio station. So this is a great location, 106.1. And they snapped it up, and it's a very, very low wattage. It's not even... It's just
100.
A couple of hundred watts.
100,
it's nothing. So it only goes a couple square blocks. And everybody who listens to it, I haven't, says it's good, and it does exactly what Charles Clemens says. Now, Adam Riley has been doing some reporting. Apparently, Clemens missed some kind of a window, though, to actually legally apply for this. We're investigating that. We're going to have it on Beat the Press tonight. But still, the photographs of those marshals going in there and tearing down this guy's antenna, taking away his little broadcasting box and this little tiny... It's embarrassing. This is what we want our federal marshals doing?
That's exactly. Those are almost the exact same words I said to Callie 45 minutes ago about this. And by the way, you made a point which I hadn't thought about, is the station location of the dial is pretty rich, the 106.1. But then the solution is work something out, right. But then maybe Clemens didn't do. You know, Callie mentioned to us that Governor Patrick had comments, and we've since from the State House News Service gotten them. He said he was incredibly disappointed by the action of the federal marshals this morning. His office tried to dissuade the U.S. attorney from taking action. Quote, you'd like to think of them bringing more of a problem-solving approach. Touch is a pretty important voice in the community. I've been on it many times, and I have tremendous respect for the team over there. And he says our lawyers, meaning the governor's office lawyers, have been in touch with lawyers at the station and the FCC in an attempt to resolve this thing.
You know, we got an email earlier when we were talking about this with Callie from George, one of our loyal emailers, who said he's been involved with the FCC. And he points out that pirate radio stations operate without any oversight, badly installed transmitter, even a low-power one can wreak havoc in the radio spectrum. Yeah. And how would you feel if the cops or firefighters, wouldn't be able to get to your, wouldn't work in your neighborhood because of the local pirate station, their transmitters, by the way, if there was a badly tuned transmitter, et cetera, et cetera. So there may be some issues with interference with other kind of radio transmitters.
I think that there's...
But the solution seems to be what you mentioned, or you're looking into, illegal quasi-legal, or at least legal enough that they can operate. Because everybody, from the governor on down, admits they fill a hole. They provide a service that a lot of the major stations with a lot of wattage are not.
Apparently, they shut down two other pirate radio stations as well. I'm not familiar with which ones those are or where they were. So it wasn't that they were just targeting Charles Clemens. But, our favorite community activist, Jamal Crawford. Did you see what he said yesterday?
Nope.
No, I did not. Hilarious. I mean, he's always way over the top. He said, if black people set out to do everything the legal way, we'd never get anywhere. And he's like, what? like they would never possibly be awarded a legitimate FCC license because they're black people. I don't know about that, Jamal. But
well, I don't think, what's fair is, and again, I didn't know anything about this sort of halfway license you were describing a minute ago. A major FCC license is a major endeavor and a major financial undertaking. So you may be right about that. But if this second, I was going to say second class, but it is second class kind of thing would allow them to operate within the bounds of the law, then if that's right, then it seems to be. You know, the one other thing we should have mentioned, too, one of the complaints during the campaign, and I don't know how meritorious this was, is that he was violating FCC regulations, but of course he wasn't subject to them because he was a pirate radio station promoting his own candidacy. And while there's not the equal time doctrine as such, if you're promoting one candidacy, you have to give comparable time.
No, you don't.
Yeah, we have to give some. Yes, you do. Don't you?
You don't. Not anymore.
Oh, I thought you did, even though the equal time thing had been repealed. I thought there was balance thing that had to do.
Not really. Really. We didn't give Charles equal time, did we?
We had him. No, he was here. He was one of the 11 candidates we had in.
Sure, shifted him for the most part. I mean, he came in for the debate, but we didn't. And I don't think we overly engaged him that night either. But that's beside the point.
Well, there's some legitimacy. Yeah.
Remember the guy that we didn't engage much at all? That sort of
what was his name?
I don't know.
I can't remember either. He didn't win, did he?
More talkative than Charles.
I remember going to look for him in his neighborhood and knowing.
I remember that.
David James Wyatt. Thank you, Chelsea, for reminding us.
Crack staff. Wow. I was right next door to his house, and he was.
No one knew. Didn't you have say no one? Didn't you interview people in his neighborhood and never heard of the guy?
Yeah.
Wasn't that you?
Yeah. It was kind of funny.
Well, of course, you interviewed neighbors of Ed Markey, who said they hadn't seen him in 36 years. Also, so I guess it's
one of my favorite things to interview the neighbors. Do you know who your neighbor is, the famous United States senator or governor, whatever he is?
Okay, so there's something called A Fighting Chance. It would be the new book by Elizabeth Warren. It's about her, first of all, have you seen this thing yet?
Yes, I have.
Have you read any of it or no?
Just flip through.
Lovely pictures.
Yeah.
Can I read the beginning of what I thought was a terrific piece yesterday before we start the discussion? Matt Visor, who's one of the Washington Bureau people for the Globe. It's going to take a second, so bear with me. It's an odd contradiction. Senator Elizabeth Warren has shaped an image of herself as a woman of the people, fighting for common middle-class families, unimpressed by her own power. But since her 2012 election, the mass Democrat has typically walled herself off from the media, refusing to answer questions in Senate hallways, frequently declining interviews, and adopting some of the same guarded, cautious communication strategies as the corporate CEO she has pilloried. Now listen to this. Several weeks ago, a Warren aide physically blocked and reprimanded a Globe reporter seeking to ask Warren a question about the Boston Marathon.
Bombings.
Bombings. She does have a media thing, okay, which she describes in the book.
So
right?
Now, yeah, I went right to this. So in the book and in the Globe today, there's a piece about how this whole cautious approach with the media got going. So she cites this interview with this nice young man who I happen to know because he's the son of a good friend of mine, Sam Jacobs. You know, he's a young guy. He's like 25, 26 at the most. Talented young reporter from the Daily Beast. She gives him an interview, and part of it is about Occupy Wall Street. And at some point, she takes credit for kind of, you know, being the, I don't know how she phrases it, but the backbone of the movement or something.
The intellectual foundation
there
of the movement.
The intellectual. So she is horrified when she sees this article, mm-hmm. and gets her aides and everything. Get out that tape. We were recording it. There's no way I could have said that. Of course, she said that exactly. So it was all reported accurately and in kind. But she felt like she had said too much, and it made her look like a buffoon. And from that day forward, she decided she wasn't going to, you know, meet out any interviews.
I think it had something else to do with other things as well. I mean, the constant...
The Native American thing, that drumbeat, yeah.
Drumbeat, exactly, about whether she was legitimately Native American.
She writes in the book about how hurt she was about that, too.
Yeah.
And by the way, she also writes, apparently, and I only know this because I haven't read it yet, I'm going to try to read it this weekend, in the Visor piece, she's troubled by another aspect. He said, when her brother David said she's not a lesbian.
Yeah.
And the implication is that Warren's saying, you know, how outrageous is the press is asking about this, but Visor goes on to write, what Warren leaves out in her retelling is, as Jacobs said in his article, Warren's brother offered the comment about Warren's sexuality unprompted, saying she is not a lesbian. I think I read that. That was comical. So the reporter didn't say, oh, by the way, is your sister a lesbian? The brother said, I know you're not asking, but my sister is not a lesbian.
Ridiculous.
I mean, and so, but you know what's interesting to me, and I've had this discussion with Marjorie a lot since the Senate campaign. It is amazing to me that somebody is, and you can like her politics or hate her politics, she is really smart. She is really smart.
Really smart.
Really good speaker. The fact that she has this thing, even if these stories are accurate, that it, you know, she apparently says she vomited, used her words, before she went on Jon Stewart. She was so nervous. Even if that's all true, you go through the cycle, you survive it, you get elected to be one of the 110 most powerful people in the United States. It really hasn't. She's been kind enough to be with us a couple of times, but it hasn't changed dramatically.
No.
Why is that when people have that big a brain? And also, she's got quite a great presence, I think,
and
when
also,
she decides
once,
to do
something. Once you break it down and you start frequently talking to the press like Peter King or somebody from,
yes.
you know, New York Congressman.
It's easy.
Yeah, it's easy.
Amen.
Yes, it is easy. But you know what is interesting about her, though? I've covered her many times when she's out at some event. And because you can't get her otherwise, you have to come out to her at an event. But she's quite, like, face-to-face. She's really good. She defends herself. I mean, she has no hesitation. She doesn't seem nervous. She says this or that. I mean, I had to ask her several times about the Native American stuff. And she was good about it.
Well, you know what she also does, which I like? She's willing to take on the reporter. A lot of politicians, when they finally agree to be interviewed, don't want to seem like they're arguing. But she is willing. And I like that kind of thing. It just surprises me. And
now, on the other hand, when I interviewed her husband, I had to interview him in the middle of the campaign headquarters in a little desk.
They wouldn't let you in the house, right?
With all this activity. Yeah, I sort of felt like I was radioactive. So
I'm okay. If people have a privacy thing and say,
well,
even though I'm running for public office, I don't want you in my living room.
Well, you don't have to be in someone's living room. You don't have to be in the middle of a
with
absolutely no place to put your stuff. You have a nice table somewhere. You go to an office somewhere. I get people don't want people in their house. That's fine.
I actually was in her. I did an interview
in
her
house.
You were? Well, there you go.
What's it like?
You did better than I did.
You know, it's one of these classic, traditional, kind of Victorian-style houses in
Cambridge. West Cambridge, right off Mass Ave,
Beautiful house.
Yeah.
The dog was still alive when I was there, the beautiful golden retriever.
But I tell you, she's a rising star. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are speculating that this book has to do with her possibly running in 2016.
Well,
hard to believe.
She says she's not. Mind.
Well, wait. When I say hard, when I have acknowledged you, I don't. If Hillary Clinton, I'd say the odds are 1 in 1,000, decides not to run, I think it's a total free for all. Biden is not a runaway guy, so I think she is totally in the mix, and she is the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. In any case, can we talk about something that obviously is more serious and more timely? You, Emily, have done some, I think the consensus is spectacular interviews
with some of
the survivors. We're going to play a little piece from one of them. This is Jeff Bowman. Everybody knows Jeff Bowman lost two legs. Jeff Bowen was the man rescued by our friend Carlos Arredondo in that iconic photograph that everybody has seen. He talks to Emily about his encounter with the older Tsarnaev brother.
It was a dense crowd. It was a lot of people, you know, we were shoulder to shoulder. And then, like, he's trying to cut through the crowd, so he, like, bumps me. And I turn around and I see him, you know, and we're right next to each other. And I kind of was like, what are you doing? Like, there's nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he kind of, you know, like, stared at me, like, with his bag. And then I just ignored him. I turned around and started to talk to Michelle. And, you know, I looked back and he wasn't there anymore. And, you know, I saw a bag laying there and then I was like, Michelle, maybe we should go. And, you know, I kind of got scared for a little bit. And
you did?
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was awkward. I thought it was just...
odd that he would drop
odd,
it there.
Yeah, odd. Like, why would someone just leave their bag there?
It was pretty real, I should say.
And you know what he said after that? He remembered that it was a JanSport
yes.
bag. He knew the type of bag it was.
This guy, I have to say, everybody kept telling him he was going to have the fog of war, that he wouldn't remember anything from before, during, and after. He never lost a second's worth of memory.
Yeah.
You know, from before having the encounter with Tamerlan Tsarnaev till when he was lying on the ground and saw both of his legs off, to seeing his friend Michelle with one of her legs poking through her pants. What he told the EMTs in the ambulance on the way, they were sort of dismissing him. He kept saying, I saw the guy, I saw the guy, I saw the guy. They were so busy working on him that they weren't listening to what he said.
Yeah.
And then all the debriefs he had with the FBI, exactly what he told them, how he drew the photographs. He was really,
you know,
remarkable.
Two things. I forgot what the first thing was, but oh, I know what it was. I try to put myself, which is, I know, impossible, in the place of some of these survivors, including some of the people you've spoken to. And all week we've seen video. We've seen the still photograph, obviously, of Carlos Arredondo and Bowman. But when you see the video of him just months after waving to the crowd on the Bruins ice, throwing out the first pitch. His book, by the way, is now on the New York Times bestseller list called Stronger. Can you imagine yourself having the strength?
Are you kidding? No.
I just can't. Or that, you know, Hazlitt, they, all these. I mean, it really is amazing.
And you know, he talked about as well that they had an FBI agent or a police officer
FBI.
Outside his room the whole time.
7 days.
That was because they feared that before they caught the bomber, what was that about?
Yeah, they were, since he knew something.
Yeah.
And they had identified each other that he might come back and try and get him. So that good for the FBI for protecting him.
He and Tamerlan Tsarnaev were basically eyeball to eyeball.
Yeah. When he said that the guy looked like he wasn't having any fun, and you could tell he wasn't there to watch the marathon.
Yeah, he looked miserable.
Yeah.
How haunting is this? Your interviews really have been spectacular.
They
really have.
I have been glued. I had to stop chewing. Interviews so I could watch the interviews. Okay.
Now, here's one of the worst segues ever. From Jeff Bowman... to this.
Roseanne Sadoya, too, has been wonderful as well. You've done a great job.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
I'm sorry. It doesn't matter how many weeks in a row we do it. It's been months now. Okay, Emily.
Right.
Generally, what you'd like me to ask you, and when I don't, you get perturbed.
That's right.
Is there a theme to this,
yes,
Emily?
There is.
Oh,
and believe
good.
It or
Thank
not,
you.
It's not so far stretched from the Jeff Bowman discussion that we just had.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Just bear with me for a second here.
Sure, we'll
As
try.
You both know, I injured myself last weekend.
You did. You're on crutches.
Playing paddleball, crutches. And I found myself listening more carefully. I actually wrote a little piece for our website about this, to Jeff Bowman, because he was talking about what it meant to be incapacitated, not being able to drive, not being able to carry your own plate of food, not being able to do anything, this helpless feeling. I had a little of that this week. However, I did get an inspiration out of this, and I'm much more open now to having the marathon come into my neighborhood as a result of this, because I just feel like I understand what it's like to be incapacitated. So, meanwhile, there's a number of things I learned through this episode, and that is what my list is today.
Sounds
okay,
good.
So, we're ready.
Yep.
Episode started last Saturday. So, here's the first thing I learned. Never, never go to the emergency room on the weekend. Do not do it. And
down,
I had two doctors tell me not to go. I was thrilled with their honesty. I can't tell you. One was an orthopedic guy, and one was somebody from my PCP practice that said, you will be sorely disappointed and dissatisfied, and you will spend your entire day there, and you will waste it.
So what are you supposed to do? Wait with your injury?
I was supposed to wait.
You did?
Yep. Smart move, Emily.
Put your leg up, ice it, and enjoy yourself. Watch the Masters. That's what they told me.
This is good advice.
It is good advice. So unless you're in a severe car accident and you've got major trauma, do not go. All right. I should have known this, but I learned that people go way out of their way to help you. You know, you've been injured. You know, people are canceling their plans. They're driving me places. I couldn't drive. They had to take my car somewhere, you know, doing all my errands for me. And then the most embarrassing part, though, was when these four guys on the court next to me, can we help? Oh, my God. Carrying me off the court. Four guys.
There's no amount of money that I would not pay for that.
Took four guys to carry me off the court.
And no one took a picture of the famous Emily Rooney?
Thank God. Yeah, they all had their phones there. Thank goodness nobody did.
Oh, my God.
And I'm, of course, yelling at the guys the whole time, don't touch my leg. It hurts so much.
Can we get an artist rendering of that?
Good
that
money would really be... for that picture.
All right. So here's another thing that happens. Yeah. You become extremely resourceful when you lose the loss of a limb. When you have a loss of a limb. I've started carrying everything in a backpack. One night, I even carried a whole bowl of penne eggplant in the backpack, you know, sidled over to the couch with the...
I do that all the time.
Do you?
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
I did.
I stayed upright.
It stayed. Well, I had it neatly tucked in there, you know.
Wow.
Resourceful. I live alone, you know.
That
so you
is
gotta
an excellent little tip.
All right, here's
what is the tip, by the way? I just realized. What was the point
of
that?
Use a backpack.
Use a backpack. Okay.
Use a backpack.
Backpack for everything.
Fine, okay.
So here's the other thing. People a lot worse off than me were offering to help. When I finally did go to a hospital, and I didn't even go until Tuesday, I think it was. People in wheelchairs and, you know, with air things, you know, tanks on their backs. And
air tanks?
Can I help you? I'm going, oh, my gosh. Do I look like I'm that desperate? It was so sweet. Let me move over for you. I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. You know, everybody's like, I'm in the same boat with some of these desperately ill and injured people, I thought. But it was very sweet. Here's the other thing. You realize how much wasted territory you cover in the morning, like, I don't know. Everybody has a routine. Shower. And then, you know,
I
go into the kitchen, get water, start my coffee, back, dry my hair, back out to do that. You can't do that.
No,
you
can't.
Everything you can possibly do in one space before you move on. And I don't know about you, but my clothes are all over the place. You know, the underwear drawer, this drawer, the jacket drawer. It's like, no. You got to have every single thing in one spot. And you got to do it the night before, unfortunately.
Is that going to happen once you're fully recovered? Is that how you're going to live your life? Good. Okay. I think that's a question a lot of people
have.
All right.
Go ahead. This one is questionable. I've gotten good at using Uber, and I've learned a lot about Uber. It's like, okay. First of all, the guys, the drivers.
Oh, this is the cab thing.
It's a cab alternative. Oh, okay. Yes.
It's very convenient. It's very fast. I'll say that. The minute you hit send, they come right away. None of the people had ever heard of GBH, which I thought was weird. And every time I asked one of them where they were from, they said Cambridge.
Cambridge.
That must be like a code for something. Like,
they never heard of GBH.
Yeah, never heard
of
it.
MA are from Cambridge? Yeah. I don't think so. In Cambridge, you know, we only have one station. You know, there's a
WGBH?
The city council when I was there
That's
passed
right.
a resolution.
Okay.
Yes.
This,
sorry.
You're
going to
think I'm kidding. I was actually handed a prescription for something called crutch evaluation.
Hmm. What is that exactly?
I had to go to crutch evaluation.
How'd you do?
It took me an hour and a half. I sat there. That was the longest wait I had through the entire ordeal. Crutch evaluation.
What are they evaluating?
You know, whether you're using them properly or whether they're the right height or, you know. They filled the prescription.
This is a fairly complaint-free thing, which I did not expect at all. But go ahead.
Okay, finally.
Finally.
You can tell people anything and they'll believe you. I'm coming down the hallway yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Two different people who I don't know well stopped me and asked me what happened. I said, deadpan, skydiving. One of them said, oh, really? My colleague is a big skydiver. I should have him talk to you. I said, okay. I said, actually, I should be flattered. You think I'm skydiving?
It's beautiful.
It's great. Anyway, that's...
In any case, before you go, that was an excellent list. I just want to say, when I heard that Emily was injured, I'm embarrassed to say, I sent her a text, and the first thing I said is, I know this is horrible, but when I heard you were injured, the first thing I thought is, there's an Emily's List in the making. She texted me back immediately and said, I had the exact same
and
thought.
And it's true.
In any case, what are you doing tonight, Emily Rooney?
We're doing Charles Clemens and Touch 106 and them dismantling the radio station. We're doing that. We're doing this great controversy about the Pulitzers. All the knives are out. Everybody's stabbing each other in the back about who got one. Love that story.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got that going.
We'll see you tonight. Feel better.
Well, thanks.
Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for Open Mic. You can keep up with the weeknights on channel.
Channel 2 at 7 for Greater Boston, and tonight for Beat the Press, and we hope you do feel better soon, Emily. Up next, a father and daughter duo, both doctors, both marathon runners. They crossed the finish line last year and stayed to help those injured in the blast. They're back to run Monday's marathon. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Remember last winter? Well, here's one good thing that happened. More than 10,000 sustainers earned their very own WGBH production credit. Now, it's your turn. Sustainers break their gifts down into monthly installments that automatically renew. And if you sign on as a sustainer before the first day of summer, you might see or hear your name listed alongside some of the best producers in the country. Get your name on the list at wgbh.org/sustainer.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Grogan & Company Fine Art Auctioneers, announcing the unreserved retirement auction of A Room with a Vieux Antiques, Saturday, April 26th at their Dedham Gallery. You can view the online catalog at groganco.com. And Olin College of Engineering, collaborating with educators across the globe to revolutionize engineering education and spur the next generation of innovation. More information available at olin.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. Last year, when Dr. Natalie Stavis and her father, Dr. Joe Stavis, neared the marathon finish line, it marked the beginning of something completely unexpected. They heard bombs go off, both of them being doctors, one race to help the wounded, another race to help runners who were stranded and confused. They are running again in this year's marathon. They join us in Studio 3. Natalie and Joe, it's a pleasure to see you both.
Oh, well, thank you for having us.
It's our first father-daughter duo, by the way, ever on the quiz.
It is.
We're pretty excited.
It is.
Well, good. Well, thank you for having us here.
But before we get to the quiz, we've read a lot about you guys. You got to mile 26, and then, of course, the race was stopped. Tell us first, Natalie, what you did at that point.
You know, I remember my dad and I, we were running, and we heard the bombs go off, and initially, we didn't know what had happened, but pretty quickly we realized something had gone horribly wrong. And I looked at my dad and I said, "Dad, people are injured. We have to get there." And I took off as fast as I could, running towards where we thought the injured were at the finish line.
And police tried to stop you, from what I understand,
relentlessly. But fortunately, I'm faster than the police. Well, not fortunate for them, but for me on that day. I was faster than them and was able to get to close to the finish line when a police officer actually was able to stop me. And I said, "Oh, I'm a physician. I'm a kid's doctor. Let me help." And he actually let me through.
So what did you encounter? I know that you helped some people that were in pretty dire straits.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I don't really even have the words to describe what I saw. It was just absolutely horrific. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And the pictures that we all see, you know, that have been all over the news don't really even do it justice. You know, the pictures don't have the smell and the sounds and the taste and everything that was there at the finish line that day.
One of the people you're trying to help didn't make it, correct?
She unfortunately tragically passed away, yes.
Was this Lingzi Liu?
Lingzi Liu,
was?
Lingzi yes. Liu.
And Joe, you are Dr. Joe in this particular case. You helped a different segment of the population who also had health risks, which I wasn't even thinking about until I read about you. Tell us what you did, if you would.
Oh, at this part of the race, towards the end, you know, the body starts to go into kind of a shutdown phase, and dehydration and things like that set on. And many of the runners really try to gun that last few miles or the last segment. And so when the race stops and all the runners were getting jammed up on Calm Avenue there, a lot of people were kind of going into some shivering and shaking, and the body starts to shut down and dehydration. And so at that point, we were under the shade and people were getting cooled and kind of hypothermic. And a lot of people felt a little bit dehydrated and were passing out. And we were just assisting some of those runners. And there's a large age spectrum of runners that run in this marathon, as you know. So there's even people in their 60s to 80s. And they were suffering from some of the side effects of just this rapid hypothermia and stopping the race at that point.
You're a radiologist, your daughter is a pediatrician. Healers by trade, are you different at what you do because of what you experienced last April 15th, Natalie 1st?
I think so.
How so?
I think I'm different. Well, for one thing, what happened last year completely changed my trajectory as a physician. I went from going to be applying to a major fellowship to now being more of a community advocate. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I'm working in the community with this kind of new resolve to reach out to kids who are at high-risk kids in the community and try to intervene in their life in a positive way through running. Because I believe that all problems can be solved through running.
Why?
I think it teaches you resilience. I think it teaches you respect. I think it teaches you discipline. I think it teaches you courage. For me, running and setting a goal to run any distance, 5K, half marathon, full marathon, teaches you qualities that are valuable for life. And so I feel that if we can give this gift of running to children who are at high risk, then we can maybe give them the tools to succeed in life and get out of whether it's poverty or whether they're in a gang or whether they're, you know, living in turmoil.
Is there a name for this operation?
Oh, yeah. So what I'm running with now is this amazing group called Soul Train. And it's so phenomenal. And so we're mentors for kids. So we have a big run, a half marathon we're doing.
And Joe, Dad, you're running again. Well, you're both running again this year. You're running again this year. Now, did you have to go through much of a rigmarole to get your number, or was that okay for you guys?
Well, they allowed the non-finishers a bib number this year.
I think so you're all set.
They felt, kind of sorry for us that we were so close and we just couldn't quite get to
we're at the end. They put us at the end.
Yeah.
But wait a second. Did I read, and I don't, I'm pretty sure I read the last few months or something about the two of you. Was last year to be the last time? You'd run five marathons together, some such thing. And did I read that it was going to be the last one? What was that about?
Well, as a baby boomer, maybe you'll understand this, that there is a point when you want to kind of try to hang up your running shoes and maybe get into something that's maybe not as rigorous.
So was that going to be the last?
That was going to be my last marathon with Natalie. I know it's a little bit of an unusual father-daughter event.
And that you stay together all that time.
Well,
amazing.
You beat me once.
Yeah, I did. Well, I would always let Natalie finish first.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Different versions of events
here.
I
know. I can't remember. You know, your brain does become a little hypoxic in some of these events. Yes, it was. But since we didn't finish, we're going one more round, and we'll see what happens.
Okay.
It's pretty exciting. Before we take a break, and then we're going to actually come back and do the quiz, I didn't get to ask you what I asked your daughter. Are you changed? You've been at this a lot longer, obviously, than your kid. Are you a different doctor, a different person as a result of what you saw and experienced last year?
Absolutely. I think that everybody that was a part of this, and as you recall at that time, it went out in all sorts of medias. It went on Twitter, went on web pages and blogs and just on and on and on. So I think that generation or the people that saw that event have to be touched and inspired and surprised and moved in many ways. Personally, it has opened up my mind to a whole different aspect of people being wounded in so many ways, not only physically, but mentally, but spiritually, but and how you grow from that and how you've develop a resolve and to see the inspiration, how these people have just changed so many lives. I'm not from Boston, and I know how it affected the Boston people by Natalie's experience, but even in different parts of the country, the pebble has just sent ripples throughout the world.
You're not only not from Boston. When I read originally you were from Nebraska, I said to myself, have I ever met anybody from Nebraska?
Yeah,
and I guess
too.
I have now.
Yeah, there's one or two people out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of famous people from Nebraska.
Well, you
actually,
bet. Look
right?
at Johnny Carson.
That's the first one I was going to mention.
Yeah. I know, Larry the Cable Guy.
So there's a lot of famous personalities.
Where's Letterman from?
One of those, Kansas or one of those.
He's from,
Well,
even
same
Lawrence
thing,
Welk
right.
was from North Dakota. So,
Indiana,
yeah,
thank you,
on.
Chelsea.
Indiana.
By the way, before we take a break, if you're saying to yourself, yourself as you listen to Natalie and Joe? Is it Stavis? Is how you say Stavis? Stavis. Is that
Stavis?
Stavis. Okay. Yeah. Is Natalie was one of the three 2013 Bostonians of the Year in the Globe magazine last year. It was a great story for great accomplishment. So we'll take a break.
We are going to take a break. We're talking with father-daughter duo Natalie and Joe Stavis, both doctors and runners, ran last year's marathon, back to run Monday's race. Up next, they will challenge each other in our Friday news quiz. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Marco Werman. Some stories take time to tell.
Masked men armed with Kalashnikovs and anti-tank weapons now control every administration building.
There are many voices and they don't always agree.
They are talking about Russia's invasion. This is not true. There is no invasion and this is the reality.
Join us and hear the world.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, an affiliate of Atrius Health, providing quality primary and specialty care so that you can focus on what matters most in life. You can find a doctor near you at harvardvanguard.org and experience better care for a better life. And State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead and proud to support TED Radio Hour in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 11 p.m. here on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, if you're just tuning in, we have a father-daughter duo, our first, Natalie Stavis and Joe Stavis, for the Friday News Quiz. They're both doctors. They both help those wounded or those who couldn't finish after last year's blast. They almost crossed the finish line. They are running together in the marathon on Monday. By the way, we're just speaking to Natalie's mother, who is also in the room, who said that when she heard the blast, she was near the location of the second one. She actually was deeply concerned, understandably, about whether or not the two of them had made it through. So it's a whole family thing. And anything to get them in the competitive spirit for Monday, we will start the quiz. Which doctor do you want, Marjorie? Well,
we can do, why don't we do, start out girl, girl, boy, boy.
Fine, let's do that. Good enough.
Okay, you ready, Natalie?
Okay.
Who's Conan O'Brien talking about in this clip?
Scientists think they have definitive proof that had a wife. Yeah, maybe so, since he's not the first husband to get killed
Jesus.
After going out drinking with 12 of his guy friends.
Jump the gun, but...
Jesus.
That is correct.
Oh, very good. Who jumped the gun? Me?
No, she jumped. She was so excited.
Oh,
she couldn't even wait till the end of the clip.
Oh, this is a Jeopardy. Oh,
yeah. Okay.
Oh, you thought we were going to answer, huh? Okay.
So you were getting crushed by your daughter after one question. Here's your opportunity to even things out. You ready?
I am.
What big money earner is Jimmy Fallon talking about right here?
And get this. The White House just released tax returns, which show that he paid $98,000 in taxes last year. When he saw that, even... I was like, thanks, Obama.
Now, what is the answer? What big money earner was Fallon talking about?
Oh, are there any big money earners left in the world now?
Thank
yes,
you.
I think so. Well, who could that be?
Oh, I know.
I
well, wait a second, Natalie.
Now,
talk
I'm from
about
Nebraska.
Competition.
Is it Warren Buffett?
I'm going to say that would be wrong. And Natalie, you have a chance to
Obama.
Steal the question. Yes.
Oh,
wait a minute.
Correct.
Wait a minute. He gave the answer in the question.
Well, that was sort of a trick kind of thing
I
there.
See.
So you're up 2-0, Natalie.
Natalie doesn't fool around. Okay, let's go. Here is another one to Natalie. What prom night accessory is this newscaster talking about?
Obviously, the only thing girls are thinking about on prom night besides their date and their dress is chicken. Am I right?
Totally.
Well, ladies, your dreams just came true. KFC joined forces with a florist in Louisville, Kentucky to create this edible you can attach the actual drumstick to the this is not a joke.
Wow.
You can get it extra crispy, grilled, if you're watching your weight, or original recipe. And no, I did not make that up. That is actually true.
Okay, this is a tough one, Natalie.
This is a tough one. Your boucage. Wait, what's it called when you put the flower there? Boucage.
Bouquet or corsage.
Corsage, yeah.
You are.
Judges, you got it. That was very impressive.
That was a tough one.
An
oh
edible
my God.
Corsage.
An edible corsage. I'm not clear.
Well, I don't know what else you would eat.
Yeah.
Your dress?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't get the whole concept. Why can't you just go over to the buffet
table? Well, it's
like
a twofer kind of thing.
Yes,
if you're hungry
while you're
waiting
in the limo
line,
on the way to the prom or something, yeah. I don't know. Anyway. Okay.
By the way, you know, as you and I should have a bond, doctor. You are a radiologist. Marjorie believes that I should be admitted on the first ballot to the MRI Hall of Fame.
Oh, I've
kept most radiologists in business for the last 30 years, and so you're welcome for my contribution to your craft.
Yeah, we'll scan anything that you have there, Jim. We'll see. We'll see what.
Thank you. Very kind of you. Doctor, this is, well, two doctors. Dr. Father, here is the question, Joe Stavis. What phenomenon is comedian Craig Ferguson, describing here that happened this past week?
It's a great day if you love the and who doesn't love the Al-Qaeda? Because tonight is a very rare occurrence. It is a Tonight the be so red, Mars is going to be all like, bitch, stole my look. Be warned, doctors believe that if you stare at a for just 3 minutes, you may have smoked too much marijuana.
What phenomenon is Ferguson talking about, Doctor?
Well, I would think it's something to do with the moon, and I believe it's the red moon.
That is close enough. It's called the blood moon, which I've never even heard of before. Have you? Has anybody heard of this thing?
Mm-hmm. No, but this is very impressive. This is why
the non-contestant Stavis shook her head yes.
You know, this is why they got through their organic chemistry and made it to medical school.
I had an edible corsage that got me through.
Are you a doctor because he's a doctor?
Probably.
Yeah, but probably meaning it just happened and you think.
Okay, so how hard was the math and science part? Did it just come naturally to both of you or did you really have to struggle?
It was pretty hard. I struggled.
It was pretty hard.
It was pretty hard.
Oh, good.
Well,
that
and
makes
I, it was
better.
In the day of the slide rules for me, so and the abacus. So it did take a little bit of extra.
Days of the abacus.
Okay.
Everybody's saying, what's a slide rule? Exactly.
Okay. You ready, Natalie?
Yeah, I'm ready.
What product is Domino's adding to its crust? Here's Conan O'Brien from Brookline, of course. He's got a hint.
Domino's is in the news, gang. Domino's debuted a new pizza where instead of dough, they're using Yeah. It's called Domino's Deep Dish. You're all going to die. Instantly.
Yeah.
That's a weapon. That's also
Here, eat that.
I'd buy that.
Yeah.
Any idea what they're adding to the crust?
Man, I don't eat Domino's, but my guesses would be they're stuffing it with cheese.
I would have guessed
that's
the same
guess.
Thing.
That's
that is
a good
wrong.
Guess, but
I think,
it is.
Oh,
okay,
shoot.
Dad, here's your opportunity.
Boy, oh boy, if it's not cheese, could it be?
We'll give you a hint, which we
rarely do.
Well,
we rarely do.
A little hint. This answer actually coincidentally relates to an earlier answer. That's all I can tell you. Okay. Sorry, I have to leave it there.
Well, it's not the cheese in the moon, then I would have to say that it could be meat or chicken.
Let's give it to him. That's exactly right. Fried chicken.
In
the pizza crust.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be
I
so
saw my
weird.
Mom. I saw my mom lipping the answer over there.
Trying to help him out there?
No, normally she kicks me under the table, but that was...
How you pick it up? How would you do that? I'm not sure. With the pizza and the fried chicken, I don't get it.
You know, both, and even though, well, actually it is part of your trade, pediatrician Natalie, and not so much your father's, but I am, one of the things I'm obsessed with, as is Michelle Obama, and you're two of the fittest people we've ever had in the studio, is childhood obesity. There were some stats out, and that's why the running thing is also great. There were some stats out recently suggesting that it's on the decline, rather dramatic decline, in something that came, a study came out about a month ago. What's happening? Is Michelle Obama's message trickling down? Are people eating more healthy? What's the deal?
I think it depends on what population you actually look at, because in some populations it is dramatically on the rise. With kids, unfortunately, it's not quite on the decline yet. I would say about 1 in 3 children, I know at least in Massachusetts, are obese.
Wow.
Yeah.
Obese?
Yeah. They meet the criteria for obesity. But this is why I'm so excited that so much attention, initially for tragic reasons, but is being brought to running.
Yeah.
Because suddenly, did you know that running is up by about 15% in Boston since last year?
Is that true?
The marathon?
Yep. That's pretty
that
great,
is 100%
actually.
True. Running is up by 15%.
Well, you know, I was telling Jim before, I was down in Copley Square last night, and I could not believe, first of all, they got everything all set up.
Yeah.
But the excitement down there, it was like this village full of thin people in sneakers running around. And I guess there's so many more people this year. I think they've already begun to land. And it's got such a festive, neat atmosphere. It was really great to see.
I think runners should rule the world.
Yeah,
you know what the beauty also is? I don't have to tell you, it's also the cheapest sport,
it's so cheap.
Pretty much. You need a pair of sneakers, essentially.
I mean, technically, you could do it barefoot.
And some do, by the way.
Yeah.
Judges, do we have time for one more question before the bonus round, or should we go right to the bonus round? What's the answer? Okay, one more quick one.
It's a maybe. Okay.
This is for you.
Let's run around the block once or twice.
What's the score, judges, by the way? Do you have any idea?
Oh,
you can tie this up here.
Yeah.
You can.
Oh, boy, for the tie.
What service did Vice President Biden join this week? Listen to this news broadcast, if you would.
The vice president only joined yesterday. He already has like 50,000 followers.
Well, Vice President Joe Biden trying to be cool and joining.
He signs his pictures with VP, and Biden is already burning up. The picture already has more than 23,000 likes.
So what service did the VP join this week, Dr. Joe Stavis?
Well, he was at the one-year anniversary, I know, here in Boston. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, like...
But are you talking about a different service? Was
yeah, like
he
an internet service kind of thing.
Internet service. Yeah, it wasn't clear. Oh, okay, I see. Well, I don't know if he got on... did he get on Twitter?
No, but I'm going to give you... Actually, rather than that, how about what is it that was the product of this that's been all over the internet in the last couple of days? Do you have any idea? You can look at your wife and she'll mouth it for you.
Do we have a lifeline out here?
No.
Do we have...
Do you have a question about Kim Kardashian?
Trick, this is not another fried chicken question.
No, here's the answer.
I know all about her.
The answer is Instagram. He took a selfie of himself and the president in the presidential limo. Okay, we go to the bonus round.
Go to the bonus round.
Okay, here's
bonus
the deal.
Now, I should preface this by saying no one ever gets these questions right, so don't worry about it.
But nevertheless, since you're both marathon runners, we're going to ask you questions about, of course, the marathon candy bar. It was a stretch of braided caramel covered in chocolate. It came in 8 inches and 15 inches. The back of the wrapper, by the way, had a ruler on it to indicate its length. The bad news for you, Natalie, the candy bar was only made and distributed between 1973 and 1981, but do the best you can.
So you missed it.
Marjorie, why don't you switch genders here.
Dr. Joe Stavis
yes, Marjorie.
Here, okay? Which of these was the slogan for the marathon chocolate bar? A, it's long and long gone. B, lasts a good long time. And C, taking long, never tasted so good.
I would say C.
What's the answer, judges?
It's not here. I guess that's the wrong answer.
Oh.
Okay, it is not C. You can steal this question and have a two-point lead, 50, Natalie.
50-50 here.
A or B?
Let's go B.
Wow. Someone got one right.
No.
This never happens.
I didn't even remember what the question was.
That's good. That's perfect. It's better that way, actually.
That's how I got through chemistry.
Okay. Stavis is next.
Here's Natalie. Here's your question. You thought the marathon candy bar was retired by the Mars Company in 81. It actually got a second life by way of another candy bar that looks and tastes exactly the same. Mm-hmm. What is the name of this bar? I shouldn't even give
Snickers.
You the answer. Is A, B, or C? No, wait a second. A, Curly Whirly.
Oh.
B, your favorite letter, Long John. And C, Bigfoot. Which of the three is it, please?
Bigfoot.
That would be wrong.
Oh,
now, Dr. Joe Stavis, you can
B.
steal this. A or B?
I would say A. Curly Whirly sounds like
exactly.
something
Curly
I would call
Whirly.
It.
Yeah,
now,
I don't remember any of these candy bars, do you?
You're going to ask the last question of Dr. Joe Stavis, because if he gets this, they can leave like they're going to leave the marathon on Monday in a tie at the finish line.
Okay,
so the
here
pressure
we go.
Is on, sir.
Dr. Joe Stavis, which of these was the marathon bar mascot? A, a cowboy who carries a marathon bar instead of a pistol. B, a Greek messenger who carries a marathon bar, instead of a scroll. Or C, a pirate who wields a marathon bar instead of a sword.
Oh, my God.
Boy, oh, boy.
Pistol,
that really...
scroll, or sword.
Do you remember the marathon bar, by the way?
I may have had one or two of those in my lifetime.
Okay.
I would have to go with the Greek image here of winning and... marathon. And so I'd have to go with B.
It's not.
Oh, no.
We're going to change your rules, actually, and give you a second guess. Is it A or C? Because your daughter is busy drinking water or something. Good. Is it A or is it A or C?
That's the cowboy with the marathon bar instead of a pistol or the pirate.
We don't want friction.
I would have
family.
To go with the pirate.
Okay, let's give you a third chance.
Okay.
Is it the cowboy or is it the cowboy,
do you have
doctor?
Cowboys in Massachusetts?
Yes.
Oh, what? Okay.
The cowboy was named Marathon John. He was played by John Wayne's son, Patrick Wayne.
Give Marjorie the phone.
Okay.
There you go.
Right.
I had no idea, needless to say. It wasn't. So are you all excited about tomorrow? No, it's not tomorrow.
Monday.
It's
yeah.
Monday.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, absolutely.
So
it's going to be a great, great day. Beautiful event.
Okay.
Boston will be strong.
Well, congratulations for what you did last
year.
Congratulations for doing so well today and for what you did last year at the Boston Marathon. And good luck on Monday. father and daughter duo Natalie Stavis and Joe Stavis are both doctors. They are both running in the marathon Monday. Thanks again for joining
us. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for our Boston Marathon coverage, a special three-hour edition. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Alan Mattis, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning. Since you asked, Marjorie, yes, I do have a piece in the Sunday Globe magazine about why women are having a hard time becoming statewide office holders and entering corporate suites. And I have solutions. Yes, I do.
That's fantastic. We'll
Sunday
be
Globe
that
Magazine.
First
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks
Thank you.
Tuning in. I hope you can tune in again on Monday.